From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy.
He was inches from my face. I could feel the saliva while he was yelling at me, telling me that I should call him Sergeant or Sir when I'm speaking to him.
Systemic racism has been a cancer on the skin and the fabric of this nation that has not been remedied. It has only deepened.
The police, you know, rushed in and, you know, barged into the crowd with their batons out and started beating people up, tried to arrest some people, loading them up into the wagon.
We have dark clouds on the horizon.
Just look at some of the film clips that you've seen of people congregating, often without masks, of being in crowds and jumping over and avoiding and not paying attention to the guidelines that we very carefully put out. We're going to continue to be in a lot of trouble.
We need to expand contact tracing, and we need leaders, starting with President Trump, who have enough backbone to face reality.
The deadly new virus out there, with the potential of sitting off the next pandemic. Imagine a pandemic within a pandemic. And why are some states experiencing a second wave while other states are unscathed? Also, it was once thought that pets could not get the coronavirus. Now, doctors are changing their tune.
COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort from the Pacifica Network and our affiliates across the U.S. Today's edition is presented by Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York. I'm Linda Perry. In today's program, Senator Elizabeth Warren with Dr. Anthony Fauci on the rise of COVID-19 across the country, Dr. Michio Kaku on the new swine flu in China, Andrew Cuomo calls out Donald Trump for failing the people of the U.S., COVID-19 hitting homeless populations in Florida, Proud Boys and the anti-lockdown rallies, dismantling systemic racism, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee on reparation proposals for African Americans. All this and more. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Askia Mohammed. The mayor of Richmond, Virginia, on Wednesday ordered the immediate removal of a monument to Confederate General Stonewall Jackson from city grounds. Mayor LeVar Stoney said Confederate statues pose an immediate and growing threat to public safety.
Since the end of Richmond's official tenure as the capital of the Confederacy 155 years ago, we have been burdened with that legacy. The great weight of that burden has fallen on our residents of color, but has also placed a weight on all of our brothers and sisters who saw the unmet potential for Richmond to become an international example of a diverse, compassionate, and inclusive community.
In Massachusetts, the Boston Art Commission voted to remove a copy of the Emancipation Memorial sculpture from the public display. The statue portrays an enslaved man kneeling at the feet of Abraham Lincoln. In San Antonio, Texas, officials removed a statue of Christopher Columbus. A similar statue was removed from outside City Hall in Ohio's capital city, Columbus, named after the 15th century Italian mercenary. In Georgetown, Delaware, city officials have removed an 8-foot-high whipping post from outside Sussex County Courthouse. Delaware was the last U.S. state to carry out public floggings as recently as 1952, with a highly disproportionate number of African Americans receiving the punishment. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus met yesterday and outlined legislation aimed at ending racial injustices, including a measure to consider reparations. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee told reporters that Democratic leaders have promised to advance H.R. 40 that would establish a commission to study reparations for slavery, Jim Crow laws, and other policies that have hurt blacks over the decades. The Judiciary Committee has committed to mark up the bill this session, and the leadership has promised to bring it to the floor for a vote. The measure has been introduced in Congress many times over the past 18 years, but did not receive a formal hearing until last year in the House Judiciary Committee. Dozens of investment firms and shareholders are calling on Nike, FedEx, and PepsiCo to end their business relationships with the Washington football team unless the team changes its name, Adweek reported Wednesday. The team's owner, Dan Snyder, has refused the change since he bought the franchise in 1999. Snyder now wants another new stadium, and D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and others have said the District of Columbia won't even think about building one if he sticks with the racist nickname. Meanwhile, President Trump threatened to veto the National Defense Authorization Act if it includes a provision to rename Fort Bragg, Fort Lee, and other military bases named after Confederate leaders. On Wednesday, the Department of Homeland Security said it has set up a task force aimed at protecting monuments, memorials, statues, and other federal facilities. New U.S. COVID-19 cases rose by nearly 50,000 on Wednesday, marking the biggest one-day spike since the start of the pandemic. More than 2.6 million people have now tested positive for COVID-19 in the United States, and more than 128,000 have died. The rise in cases is not just the result of more testing. A record number of new infections is accompanied by a new high for current hospitalizations in 8 states. Global cases of coronavirus now exceed 10.7 million, and more than 500,000 people have died around the world. I'm Askia Muhammad, WPFW Washington, and WBAI New York.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This week, Dr. Anthony Fauci appeared before the Senate's Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions on the government's response to COVID-19. The last time he went before the committee was 7 weeks ago on May 12, 2020. That's when there were 20,000 new cases of coronavirus. Now there are about double that amount daily. Questioned by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Dr. Fauci testifies that the country doesn't have control over the virus, that it's going in the wrong direction.
Dr. Fauci, I'm asking you to be very direct with all of us on this. If we don't fully implement the widespread testing, contact tracing programs, and social distancing practices that everyone seems to agree that we need, can we expect these spikes in infection to keep happening in different places around the country?
Thank you, Senator. I'm always direct with you, and I'll tell you in direct answer to your question that if you look at what's going on and just look at some of the film clips that you've seen of people congregating, often without masks, of being in crowds and jumping over and avoiding and not paying attention to the guidelines that we very carefully put out, we're going to continue to be in a lot of trouble, and there's going to be a lot of hurt if that does not stop. And that
okay,
gets back.
If we don't get our act together, more and more communities around the country are going to see these dangerous surges of COVID-19. Dr. Fauci, back in March, you also said, quote, looking at what we're seeing now, you expected there to be between 100,000 and 200,000 coronavirus deaths and millions of infections in the U.S. So let's flash forward. We've already seen 126,000 deaths with infection rates rising rapidly. Dr. Fauci, based on what you're seeing now, how many COVID-19 deaths and infections should America expect before this is all over?
I can't make an accurate prediction, but it is going to be very disturbing. I will guarantee you that, because when you have an outbreak in one part of the country, even though in other parts of the country they're doing well, they are vulnerable. I made that point very clearly last week at a press conference. We can't just focus on those areas that are having the surge. It puts the entire country at risk. We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around, and so I am very concerned.
Can you make any kind of estimate on what we're looking at overall on the number of deaths before this is over? You made an estimate back in March between 100,000 and 200,000, right. But we have a lot more information now, and we're already at 126,000 deaths.
Right. I can't make a estimation because that would have to be modeled out, because when models are done, and that's where those original numbers came from, Senator, as I've said very often, models are as good as the assumptions that you put into the model, and those assumptions often change depending upon what your response is. So I would really be hesitant to give a number that will come back and either be contradicted or overblown or underblown. But I think it's important to tell you and the American public that I'm very concerned, because it could get very bad.
All right. I appreciate that, Dr. Fauci. Look, we all want our economy
to recover. Well over time, Senator Warren.
I just like the same time that my Republican colleagues got, because I want to say
right,
that we want our economy
your time
to
is
recover.
Up, Senator Warren.
But we can't keep pretending.
Senator Warren. I'm being just as fair to you as I was to Senator Sanders.
Colleagues got a lot more time.
Senator Warren,
Mr. Chairman,
I always treat you fairly, and I would appreciate your respecting the chairman's rules. If you'd like to make a closing statement, go ahead and do it. But I don't appreciate your questioning my fairness in presiding over the hearing.
Was under the understanding, based on what others had done, that you were allowing more time since we had such important witnesses.
Well, when you're chairman, you can make those decisions.
Thank you. You know, I just want to make the point that we can't keep pretending this virus is getting better when it isn't. That's how we end up with messes like the situation in Texas, racing to reopen too soon, then scrambling to close down before the hospitals get completely overwhelmed. If we don't get our act together, this is our future. Seesawing back and forth between two few restrictions, and then exploding cases and repeated shutdowns. In this future, thousands more Americans will die, and our economy will be brought to its knees. We've got to have a national strategy that makes testing available to every school, every business, every hospital, every church, anywhere that Americans come together. We need to expand contact tracing, and we need leaders, starting with President Trump, who have enough backbone to face reality, distribute our resources, set our standards, and stick to them. Because if we don't, the result is going to be more economic wreckage and more death. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Warren.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. The chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions is Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander. And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy on the Pacifica Radio Network. With the rapid spread of infection, 16 states are now quarantined from New York based on their rate of infection. In New York State, where COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths are down, and some areas are entering phase 4 of the reopening process, testing is now widely available and free to all. About 60,000 tests are being conducted each day. New York's governor, however, is anticipating ways to stay ahead of the virus. In New York City, he is postponing Phase 3 indoor dining. He says New York State has been smart in handling COVID-19 with testing, tracing, social distancing, and wearing masks. But citizen compliance is slipping, especially in New York City. He says we have dark clouds on the horizon, and he calls on Donald Trump to step up and become a good role model for the nation.
Look at what's going on around this nation. And these are facts. It's not editorial comment. Facts. Texas. Oh, there's no problem. No virus. This is all a Democratic delusion. Oh, the cases are going up. That's only because the testing is going up. Really? Then why are more people going into hospitals? People don't go into hospitals unless more people are getting sick. Fact. Arizona, states that were in denial, right? That underestimated the virus. Now they're all singing a different tune. Now they're all starting to say, we better take this seriously. We better start wearing masks. They're going backwards on their reopening plan, which is just what we talked about happening. I said, if you reopen too fast, what's going to wind up happening is you're going to have to close. And then that's going to be the worst situation. It's going to be the worst for the economy. It's going to be worse for people. And you're going to lose more people in the meantime. That is exactly what is happening. States are now having to roll back their reopening plan. Fact, the buck stops on the president's desk. That is a fact. That's what it means to be the president of the United States. He was in denial of the COVID virus from day one. It's just the flu. It's going to go away. It's going to be a miracle. It's not going up. It's only the testing that is going up. He denied the reality of this situation from day one. Reopen right away. Reopen right away. Liberate those states. I had all the demonstrations every day. Liberate, liberate, liberate. You're artificially keeping the economy closed. There's no reason. That came from him. You know what's funny in this country? Sometimes if the president speaks, people listen. Even if the president is Trump. Sometimes they listen. And those Republican governors listened. And a lot of Republicans listened. And won't wear a mask. He's holding rallies. Bringing thousands of people together in close quarters. No masks. What signal did that send to the American people? Couldn't be a problem. Here's the president of the United States bringing thousands of people together, no masks. Can't be a problem. If it was a problem, the president wouldn't do it. Wrong. Buck stops on his desk, and it's what came out of his mouth. Denying reality does not defeat reality. And he has lived in denial. And he has been denying the scientific facts from day one. He denied what his own CDC said. His CDC, when they first projected this March 13th, said at a minimum, 2 million people would be hospitalized. At a minimum, his CDC. You know how many 2 million is? The nation only has 900,000 housing hospital beds. And they said 2 million will require hospitalization. Look at what they were saying. The Peter Navarro memo in late January, 1 million could die. He denied it all. Denied his science advisors, denied the CDC, denied Dr. Fauci, denied them all. Reality wins. And reality won. And now the country is suffering because of the president. And it's time for him to change course. When you're in a hole, stop digging. Will Rogers. It's time for the president to actually tell the truth. At least have the courage to admit what everybody else already knows. You were wrong. And send a message to this nation that we have to mobilize our citizens, we have to mobilize our government, and we have to start doing something about this. And you want to take one easy step that will send a powerful message. Put a mask on it. Put a mask on it. Next time you're smiling at the camera, put a mask on it, Mr. President. It's the best thing he could do.
New York State Governor Cuomo in his COVID briefing. And you're listening to COVID Race and Democracy on the Pacifica Radio Network, presented today by WBAI New York. We'll be right back. And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network, presented by WBAI Radio, Pacifica's New York radio station. Anti-lockdown rallies have been springing up around the country, encouraging the premature reopening of many states. What are these rallies really about, and who's behind them? Fran Luck, who's a producer of Joy of Resistance at WBAI, spoke with Cassie Miller, senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
They do something called Hate Watch. They watch the right wing and report on it. Her recent article is Anti-Lockdown Rallies Are Providing an Opening for the Proud Boys and Other Far-Right Extremists. Why don't you start by telling us what's going on and also talking about one group you focus on in your article whose name is the Proud Boys.
We started seeing details about the protests kind of spreading on social media in mid-April, and on Facebook in particular, and this is a platform where far-right groups have historically really used it to organize and promote their protests. And the first anti-lockdown rally that we saw was in Lansing, Michigan, on April 15th, and at the SPLC in just April, we counted 50 rallies that took place across the country. And what we know is that a lot of these protests were organized by wealthy far-right activists. And those include groups like the Dorr family, which draws in hundreds of thousands of dollars every year operating pro-gun and anti-abortion groups. And they were responsible for creating some of the largest Facebook groups where we saw these rallies being organized. Another one is the Michigan Freedom Fund, which is linked to the family of the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. And what we've seen is that, you know, really this is a small movement. And it's organized by a small number of right-wing activists but it got really amplified through social media and through right-wing media, and it attracted the attention of Trump supporters and a lot of far-right groups, including ones like the Proud Boys.
Let's talk about the Proud Boys. Who are they, and where did they get their start?
The Proud Boys are a far-right extremist group that was founded in 2016 by a man named Gavin McGinnis, who is a right-wing media personality. At the SPLC, we label them a hate group because they vilify Muslims and they are extremely misogynistic. It's a pretty large group. They have 44 chapters around the country that we have counted. And they like to kind of portray themselves simply as a men's group or a drinking club, something in the style of like the Elks Lodge. And they claim to adhere to libertarianism or what they would call Western chauvinism, which is the idea that Western culture is superior to all others. And what that really boils down to is that they think there is a defined Western culture and that it is threatened by things like immigration, like Islam, and like feminism. Gavin McGinnis, the founder, has openly referred to himself as Islamophobic. They claim that Muslims engage in incest, that they are prone to violence, and that they present a really violent threat to white women, and they present them as invaders in the United States. And these are all ideas that really mirror a lot of the rhetoric that we see coming from groups in the white nationalist movement. Basically, what they want is a hierarchical society in which women are subservient to men. For Proud Boys, you know, women's sole purpose in life is that they should have children. They believe that women are really intellectually inferior to men and that they're not suited for work outside of the home. And the way they present it is that they're actually celebrating women for their ability to have children. And actually one of their core tenets is that they venerate the housewife.
These kind of attitudes permeate all of the right-wing groupings, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these groups really talk about gender, you know, in this very kind of nostalgic and reactionary way. You know, they want to revert back to some mythical time when, you know, men were men and women were women, and where white male dominance goes unchallenged. And the far right as a whole is really built on the idea that society should be dominated by white men. So gender is in many ways really central to how the far right mobilizes itself. And, you know, we know of a lot of people and studying the far right that the first time they come into contact with these ideologies is actually through misogyny. You know, first they kind of learn to see themselves as victims of feminism, and then they might begin to see themselves as victims of other groups. We sometimes talk about misogyny as sort of a gateway to other right-wing beliefs, but that's not to say that misogyny on its own isn't extremely dangerous and can be extremely violent.
So let's get into some of the more far-out racist theories. I want specifically for you to talk about what Boogaloo means, B-O-O-G-A-L-O-O, as well as the symbolism that our president, number 45, keeps referring to as the Chinese virus. Talk about some of that.
Boogaloo is a term that's used to explain or describe kind of an upcoming civil war. And in more extreme circles, it's used to describe upcoming race war. So it's something that we've seen pop up a lot in relation to the pandemic and to these rallies. Within the far right, there is this kind of belief that because we're experiencing something so unprecedented, because everything is sort of up in the air right now, and we're trying to ask so many questions, that this is a moment where society could be pushed towards collapse. And so this could be the beginning of the Boogaloo in their minds. And so what we saw at a lot of these reopen rallies is people wearing patches or, you know, other insignias that are associated with the Boogaloo movement. We're also seeing, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories that are circulating in those same online spaces. One of them, of course, is that this is a Chinese virus, that it was something that was created in a Chinese lab, and it was used as a bioweapon and spread by the Chinese government around the world. So that's something that we've seen kind of permeate a lot of these spaces, along with other conspiracy theories. And we know that this can have real-world impact.
Cassie Miller is senior researcher at the Southern Poverty Law Center. She spoke with WBAI's Fran Luck. And you're listening to COVID Race and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network, presented today by WBAI in New York.
COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This week, the House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The NAACP says the legislation holds all law enforcement officials accountable for their actions, ends qualified immunity for police officers, ends racial and religious profiling, empowers communities, establishes uniform policies for the use of force, mandates data collection on police encounters, bans chokeholds and no-knock warrants. It limits military equipment on U.S. streets. It requires body-worn cameras and classifies lynching as a hate crime, making it open to federal resources for investigations and prosecutions. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act has been sent before the Senate for consideration. The Congressional Black Caucus says they won't stop exerting pressure until the bill is passed in the Senate and signed by the president. A continued effort undertaken by the Congressional Black Caucus to address systemic racism is H.R. 40, a legislation which would set up a commission to study and develop reparation proposals for African Americans. Here's Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas.
The American government still owes a debt. The Congressional Black Caucus has always been at the forefront of fighting against systemic racism. Systemic racism, however, has been a cancer on the skin and the fabric of this nation that has not been remedied. It has only deepened. And H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals, is the answer to the original sin. It is, in fact, a restorative and repair approach to the extreme disparities that rendered and exhibited the horrors of the killing and the murder of my former constituent, George Floyd. His family still lives in Houston, and they too are wanting justice in the passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. But as well, we understand that the disparities that are so stark, that are reflective of the brutality, of the cruelty, the fundamental injustice and humanity of slavery have never been answered. The key question here is that as the slaves were freed, there was no tangible wealth given for their work of over 200 years. That lack of wealth reflected in the anger and anguish of those who received them that led into a broken Reconstruction, Jim Crowism, 4,000 African Americans lynched, and then a period of attempt at civil rights and the loss of the civil rights battlers, if essence, on the civil rights battlefield, affirmative action now being attacked, and now we come to a point of enormous disparities in healthcare, in the idea of wealth, the idea of education, and the idea of disparities in youth and housing and the justice system. Finally, I would say, to the question of those who ask, I did not have slaves. My family did not have slaves. This 13-member commission established by the federal government answers the question that is not the individual act of holding slaves. It is the government sanction that denied African Americans their equality and as well the government's responsibility with this 13-member commission to design the responses to the continued death, murder, and inequities in our community. This is America's responsibility to pay the American government's responsibility to pay her debt.
Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, meanwhile, in New York, on the 50th anniversary of the first Gay Pride March and the 51st anniversary of Stonewall, New York City celebrated the black trans activists who built the movement and continue to lead today. However, marchers were assaulted by New York police. Instead of using restraint, the police without masks used batons and pepper spray on marchers at the Queer Liberation March over the weekend. Liz McGillis is with GAG, heard on WBAI's radio GAG, Gays Against Guns. She was at the Queer Liberation March in Washington Square Park.
So the march itself was a beautiful event. I know that the organizers tried to keep the route under wraps because there wasn't a permit. And so to avoid like the police shutting us down like instantly, only like a couple of people knew what the direct route was going to be. And I was a little on edge, like as we were marching, because I noticed that they were on us right away. Every intersection that we passed, the police would be there, just like staring at us with like their arms folded. And after a couple of intersections, organizers and other marchers would kind of go up ahead to meet the police there and just like mimic their layup and facing them. So to be like a barrier between the police and the marchers, which I thought was very smart and very well organized. And so we went over to like the village to like near Stonewall, and then the march kind of branched off. So I know some people went to Stonewall, some people went all the way over to the pier, and I heard that there was a rally at Washington Square Park, and I saw a lot of people going over there. So I went over there myself, and there was a rally there. It was really beautiful and really well organized. There was a whole like kitchen set up for people. If you were hungry, there was plenty of water and snacks and extra masks and hand sanitizer for everyone. They had a list of all of the local churches and stuff that had their bathrooms open to us. It was a really beautiful community that they had set up. And there was a stage for speakers just to the left of the arch. So I was there, I sat down and listened to some Black trans women speak and tell their story and how this march is affecting them and what it means to them. And I started noticing a lot of people on the stage like look over, kind of like crane their neck and like look over back towards the arch. And I look over and there had been a bunch of people over there. It was like a dance party kind of going on over there. But then I see like a large crowd kind of like getting jostled. I hear people yelling. I see like what looks like smoke. So one of the organizers, you know, leaps off the stage, runs over there, tries to figure out what happens. Person on the mic says, "We need a barrier." So myself and the other white people who were listening to the speakers decide in that moment that we are going to be the barrier to protect the Black and brown people who were there listening to the speakers. So we form a ring around them and like link our arms, and we're two people deep. And we hold that for about 10 minutes. I see Jay Walker towards the fountain. He's a member of GAG. He was one of the organizers for the march itself. So I tell the people around me, hey, you know, he's going to know what's going on. I'm just going to go talk to him. So we walk over together and get the story that basically the police, you know, had shown up. They were circling us for a while. And then it felt like out of nowhere, they just, you know, rushed in and, you know, barged into the crowd with their batons out and started beating people up, tried to arrest some people, loading them up into the wagons and use pepper spray. So they had medics, so people were getting their eyes washed out, and they had ice packs for people who got, you know, beat over the head and stuff or pushed to the ground. And then we had reports that there might be the riot police coming. I saw about like 20 to 30 bicycle cops in like their like green reflective vests still on the street. So I waited, I joined the barricade again, and we held that until we heard that that the police had been officially called off. Yeah, after I decided to leave the park, I was walking around and I saw the police vans, and I hadn't really noticed it before, But on the side of the vans, they have a slogan of sorts, and it's CPR, which stands for compassion, protection, and respect. And none of those statements are true for what's been happening to Black and trans people ever.
Liz McGillis with Gays Against Guns on police violence at the Queer Liberation March in New York City. And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Linda Perry, WBAI Radio in New York. We'll be right back.
Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here. I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Picking the cotton. You're just plain rotten. You thought I was kidding, didn't you? Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. Yes, you lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady. And you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. Oh, but this whole country is full of lies. You all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust you anymore. You keep on saying, go slow. Go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Desegregation. Mass participation. Unification. Do things gradually. But bring more tragedy. Why don't you see it? Why don't me, just give me my equality. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody knows about Alabama. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. That's it.
Welcome back. You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, presented by the Pacifica Radio Network.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg, reporting from New York's Police Plaza, where Black Lives Matter activists have come to support legislation proposed by City Councilwoman Inez Barron for the election of a civilian complaint review board with disciplinary powers to oversee police abuse complaints.
I am invigorated to stand beside my brothers and my sisters of chains. It isn't the death of George Floyd that brought us here, but it is the movement that his name, his words, his death, and his legacy has fueled. What a coincidence that his dying words were, "I can't breathe." The campaign for an elected civilian review board has been waiting 5 years for this moment. And it's only fitting that this moment should come on the heels of a movement calling for justice, for police accountability, and for reform nationwide.
That's right.
We are proud to stand with the Barons in announcing the submission of our legislation to hold the NYPD accountable. We watched Eric Garner cry out, "I can't breathe," and New Yorkers said, "Enough is enough." Now we've watched George Floyd cry out, "I can't breathe," and America is saying, "Enough is enough." Our multiracial, multigenerational, and grassroots movement was born from Mr. Garner's cries, but the movement born from Mr. Floyd's cries amplifies our purpose and the need for our legislation. Sure, we can reflect on the behaviors of individuals like Derek Chauvin and Daniel Pantaleo, or we can focus on the system that enables them to target our communities, a system where individual monsters become the face of an institution that refuses to take a stand. Legislation provides direct, immeasurable relief in the form of restorative justice to communities who fear speaking out and are used to having their cries ignored. An elected and empowered board is what we need to put the power back into the hands of the people most affected. Right now, there is no system of accountability for the NYPD. The CCRB is a performative display of political favoritism meant to protect those in power and quiet the masses when they ask, where is the solution? Of course, officers are allowed to drive their vans into peaceful protesters. And of course, they are allowed to murder us and mock our dying words. For years, these officers have seen no real accountability for their misdemeanors other than a loss of vacation days.
That's right.
But the time to reshape the system is now. Let us discipline officers who violate our communities and open the door for healing as we are given the opportunity to take part in the process of accountability. So we, the campaign for an ECRB, are proud to announce the submission of our legislation, sponsored by the honorable and legendary Councilmember Inez Barron. Backed by the campaign for an ECRB, a citywide coalition fueled by pain and inspired by change. We ask our city's legislators to get ready to stand behind this massive community-led reform effort by passing the legislation that dismantles the outdated, repressive CCRB and replaces it with an elected and empowered board with a special prosecutor.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Pacifica Radio, New York.
And you're listening to COVID Race and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network, presented today by WBAI in New York.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and host of Exploration. Every week, we discuss the cutting edge of science and its impact on society. Well, there's a new virus out there, perhaps waiting to jump out. Will we have a double whammy of a pandemic within a pandemic? Now, this is no joke. Already, authorities in China and the World Health Organization have issued an urgent warning. Now, this new virus is a variation of the old swine flu virus, H1N1. Back in 2009, it terrorized the world, killing an estimated 285,000 people. This new virus, called G4, has been tracked since 2016 and is apparently a descendant of that earlier virus. So far, it infects mainly pigs. In fact, 10.4% of workers in the pig industry in China have already been infected. Ominously, 4.4% of the general Chinese population has also been exposed. And China has the largest pig population, with almost 500 million pigs acting as a reservoir for the flu. So, what's the danger? First, G4 is highly infectious, rapidly spreading among pigs. Second, it has already spread from pigs to humans. The danger is that it might one day spread from humans to humans, setting off the next pandemic. So far, this has not yet happened. So, the good news is there's no need for panic. We just have to monitor it very carefully. And why should we care? Because you see, 60% of all diseases, roughly, come from animals. For example, the seasonal flu comes from a combination of ducks, pigs, and humans. In fact, pigs act as a genetic mixing bowl for avian, pig, and human viruses. Now, you see, this is the price we pay for civilization. Since ancient times, we lived in small groups like nomads outdoors. Epidemics were unheard of. But then, with the coming of agriculture and cities, crowded conditions, unsanitary conditions created the very first epidemics. Now, as society expands, we begin to trespass on these ancient grounds inhabited by viruses. Cities became empires. And soldiers brought back not just loot, but also viruses from foreign lands. And with the coming of shipping during the Middle Ages, we had plagues which could wipe out half the European population. And today with jet planes, we can spread viruses within a matter of hours. And speaking about viruses, we are now witnessing a second wave of the coronavirus. After Memorial Day, a second wave has hit the United States, coinciding with the opening of restaurants, beaches, and the ending of a lockdown. So, what's behind it? Well, there's a one-to-one correspondence between those nations and those states which were negligent and lax, and those which are now experiencing the second wave. For example, California, Florida, Arizona, Texas let their guard down, and they're now experiencing this surge. However, on the other side of the spectrum, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, were states which remain vigilant, and they do not have a surge. The same thing applies to nations. England, Sweden, were slow to have a lockdown, and are now experiencing a surge. Other nations like Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea were vigilant and are now experiencing very low levels of the coronavirus. So there's a lesson here. Our behavior has consequences. And lastly, can your pet spread the virus? This was once thought to be almost impossible by many doctors, but now we're not so sure. Already, there are documented reports of tigers, lions, minks, dogs, and cats catching the virus from humans. Some farm animals like pigs, mice, chickens, and ducks seem to be immune to the coronavirus. So, what should you do? Well, you should err on the side of caution and treat your pets as part of the family. Do not let them play freely with other animals where they can perhaps spread the virus or catch the virus from other pets. Michio Kaku for Pacifica National Radio.
You've been listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. This program was produced at Pacifica Radio's WBAI New York by Linda Perry. You heard Senator Elizabeth Warren, Dr. Anthony Fauci, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, WBAI's Fran Luck and Casey Miller with the Southern Poverty Law Center, Liz McGowan with Gays Against Guns, WPFW's Askia Mohammed, WBAI's Mimi Rosenberg, and Dr. Michio Kaku. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy.